And we return. It is today's topical current, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Do you remember that Friday in 1963, Bonnie?
Indeed. I think we all do.
Yeah.
I mean, anybody.
I remember seeing Lee Oswald shot on live TV.
So did I.
It was amazing.
By Jack Ruby.
Well, today we discuss perhaps the most confounding crime in history, the assassination of JFK in Dallas. With us is journalist Anthony Summers. He's the author of Not in Your Lifetime, 50 Years On, Weighing the Evidence. And he joins us from Ireland. Is that Cork County, Anthony?
No, County Waterford, next door.
County Waterford. Because I always see the Cork County in the crossword puzzles.
Well, good to have you with us.
Good to be with you. I always enjoyed doing any part of NPR.
Oh, thank you. So 50 years later, we still have more questions than answers. How does this book that you've written differ from your original publication in 1980, and why have you turned your attentions back to the case?
Well, it is, as you yourself have said, it's one of those things that won't go away. I've wanted it to go away, and perhaps the best way is to start where I started on the case. At the very moment that it happened, I was at Oxford University as a student, a young student of 18, pulling pints in the bar. With the time difference, it was early evening in the UK. And I got a call that evening from the editor of the then major current affairs program in the UK, for whom I'd been moonlighting to make some money, and because I had grand ideas of myself as a reporter, in the vacations. And he said, could I join a team to go to Dallas on a plane that he was chartering out of Heathrow Airport? Well, can you imagine that kind of offer at the age of 18? I said, of course, yes, and got ready to leave, only to be stopped by a phone call from his assistant to say that they'd found somebody with more experience. So I didn't cover that first huge story, and I stayed away from it like the plague for a very long time. Certainly during those years in the late 60s, what I call the Jim Garrison years, when the district attorney in New Orleans was running that circus of an investigation.
Is that why you stayed away from it?
Yes, because I thought it was the kind of thing in which a journalist's reputation would disappear without trace. There were so many clowns involved in that whole thing. And I later met the man himself, and he really was the ringmaster, not a reliable person in any way. So I stayed away from it, and I was busy covering conflicts, Vietnam and the Middle East and so on. And then come 1979, I learned from a colleague in Washington that the House Assassinations Committee, the second official investigation, was likely to come up with a conspiracy finding. And that, of course, was a reversal of the Warren Commission finding that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin with no further complexity to it, really. And I made a documentary for the BBC. And in the course of the documentary, I was really shocked to find that American media had really covered the story very poorly. Of course, they covered the tragedy, the event, and so on. But then after that, when the first investigation was proceeding, there were no Woodward and Bernstein digging into this story. And one can tell that, I think, for those who have my book, Not in Your Lifetime, by looking at the end of it in the source notes. There were hardly any references to major newspapers, which is very bizarre indeed. And I felt that what I'd done deserved much more than the documentary, and so for my sins, I plunged into it and wrote a book. And somehow, to go to your question about what's different, somehow I escaped at that point being dubbed a conspiracy theorist, which I'd feared. And then I revisited it when literally millions of pages of documents were released under a Clinton Records law designed to pry material on the case out of the National Archives and out of the agencies. And a lot of stuff spilled out that hadn't been there before, that changed material that was in the book. And also by that time, I was a bit more grown up. We're talking late 90s now. I was a bit more grown up, and some things had become much clearer. So I cleaned the book up and dropped things that were surplus to requirements. And then, because it's the 50th anniversary now, my publisher asked me if I would revisit it again. And I did so willingly, because I think this is the moment at which the case is going to sort of topple over into out of current affairs and into history, and that there was a sort of a duty, if it doesn't sound too quixotic and idealist, a sort of a duty to do so. And I did a little more research, and that all seemed, that led me to think even more that the job needed doing. So we have now, I think, a very different book from the book that I originally wrote.
So bottom line, was there a conspiracy to kill the president, or did Oswald act alone?
I think anybody who really knows about this case knows that the one thing that we don't know is an answer to that question. The thing was so badly done at the beginning, so badly investigated medically at the autopsy and afterwards in the course of the Warren Commission, and then cluttered up with all sorts of stuff in the years that followed, some of it just gossip and rumor. I alluded to the New Orleans investigation of Attorney General, District Attorney Jim Garrison, that the whole thing has been sort of coated with fog. And what I've tried to do in this book is not to come out with it's a conspiracy or it isn't a conspiracy, because that is an unanswerable question. It seems to me we're going quickly, rather early on in this conversation, to what I think about it.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask me what I think about it, I think that there is real reason for doubt that the Warren Commission account of Oswald, the lone assassin, with no other complications at all, is the real story. I think it's more complex than that. I think that Oswald undoubtedly was guilty of something, but it wasn't necessarily being on the sixth floor behind a gun that day. And that very likely, as the House Assassinations Committee concluded, that there was someone else involved.
Now, Oswald was a disturbed loner. He was goofy enough to want to move to the Soviet Union. He was a wife beater, a Marine sharpshooter. Why would he need any help from anyone else? And he also narrowly missed shooting General Edwin Walker, who was a virulent Kennedy hater.
Well, you made a string of statements there. and one could pick them off one by one.
Well, go ahead.
He wasn't a particularly good marksman in the Marines, but he was nevertheless a marksman several years, we're talking 4 or 5 years before the assassination. Whether he was a wife beater or not, and I don't know from the good information we have that he clearly was such a wife beater, that doesn't make him a presidential assassin.
Right.
But just going to Oswald, the evidence about him and about him being involved in the assassination is, as the Assassination Committee established, they're certainly shaky, and we could go into detail on that. But the key troubling thing that should be raised always about Oswald is that he had no motive. The Warren Commission couldn't find a motive for him. He didn't seem to have done it, as sometimes people claim, in order that he'd be famous or infamous, celebrated as the man who killed the president, because on the contrary, in the hours that he remained alive until he was shot by Jack Ruby, he did not say, yes, I did it. He said, to the contrary, no, I didn't. And I've been framed, and I will be able to show how I've been framed. I'm not saying that he's being truthful there, and I'm certainly not saying that he was innocent of anything at all. But there are major unanswered questions, and there always have been, about Oswald.
Do you believe that he was framed, and by whom? Or what have you discovered in your research? Forget what you believe, because I realize you just are not taking a stand.
I won't take the bait on that, no.
Right.
Because I think nobody who knows anything about this case will give sure answers. And you can't give sure answers because the mess we have been left with in terms of reliable information is such a muddle.
The idea that he was framed, that he said he was framed.
The idea that he's just framed, that's his claim. I didn't say that I lean necessarily towards that.
Right.
I think that he was clearly involved in something that day. He may, and it seems likely that he did, he may have shot the policeman who was shot in the hours after the assassination of the president.
Tippett.
As for being framed, there is a very interesting but complex, even for an NPR lengthy radio conversation, series of events that occurred in the weeks before the assassination.
Okay, we're going to just stop right there because that's what we want to get to. We need to take a break on today's Topical Currents. We're speaking with Anthony Summers. He's an award-winning author, a BBC journalist. He covered events in the United States and wars in Vietnam and the Middle East. And his latest book is an updated version of Not in Your Lifetime, originally published as Conspiracy, 50 Years on Weighing the Evidence, the defining book on the JFK assassination. Let's take that short break and we'll come and pick it up where we left off.
And 20 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Current. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, we're joined by journalist Anthony Summers. We're talking about his book, Not in Your Lifetime, which covers the events surrounding the assassination of John F. Kennedy. If you'd like to join in, I'm sure many of you do, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. And also email, that's radio@wlrn.org. Anthony Summers, I recently finished a book called Dallas 1963, which very graphically paints the picture of Dallas and what was going on. It was a big haven for very radical right-wingers, the John Birch Society and segregationists. Of course, the Dallas Morning News was published by a man named Dealey, and Kennedy was killed, oddly enough, in Dealey Plaza. Could you comment on that?
I think, and of course, there was the suggestion early on that, well, the suggestion even before he left Washington, that Dallas was a dangerous place to go to. There was an awareness of danger, certainly of political danger, if not danger from somebody or somebody's behind a gun. But I've seen absolutely no evidence over the years that right-wingers in Dallas, who were simply of the right in Dallas, were responsible in any way for the assassination. Before the break, you were asking me what I thought had happened.
And right.
I think it's a longer conversation, but essentially, one can rule out many things, but one cannot rule out the possibility that there was a conspiracy behind the assassination. And if there was, I think that it came from the direction of the anti-Castro people. The key to understanding the Kennedy assassination at any level, even if you think Oswald did it, is Cuba. An entire generation of people were misled by the Oliver Stone movie JFK, which somehow suggested that it was to do with Vietnam and the military-industrial complex. And that was a disservice because there is absolutely no evidence that that was the case. On the other hand, there is good evidence that in some way it involved Cuba. At its simplest, if you believe the Warren Commission version, Oswald had capered in public as a pro-Castro leftist. And one could say that because there were, at the time, ongoing plans and plots by the CIA and the anti-Castro exiles to kill Fidel Castro, that it was Fidel Castro who struck first. One could say that. I don't think the evidence supports that. But on the other hand, one could say that the anti-Castro people, which includes not only the exiles, extremists among the exiles who felt they'd been betrayed by Kennedy, but also elements of organized crime, more simply the U.S. Mafia, were involved in the assassination. In losing Havana at the time of the Castro Revolution, the organized crime people had effectively lost a place as valuable, maybe more valuable at the time, than Las Vegas. And they were under unprecedented pressure from the Kennedy Justice Department, of a kind that the organized crime in the United States had never known before. There was a shared motive there, and the principal suspects, indeed, of the House Assassinations Committee, the second official investigation, were indeed two particular mafia leaders and elements of the anti-Castro movement.
And who were the mafia leaders?
The two that are named are the two ones that are principally named, and in it both by the committee in its report, and also very much so in the literature since then, are Santo Trafficante, who ran, as you people well know, was the key guy in the Florida area, and Carlos Marcello, who was the key man in the Southeast and Louisiana.
If you want to join in this conversation with Anthony Summers, please call us 1-800-743-9576. We're looking at the JFK assassination 50 years later. 1-800-743-9576. You can email radio@wlrn.org.
Anthony Summers, tell us more about the audio business that has been debunked now, that there had been a second gunman. It turned out that the tapes from the police radios show that was in error. Could you clear that up for us?
I'm not a scientist, but indeed an acoustic scientist, but the bottom line is that the Assassinations Committee in Congress was persuaded towards its conspiracy verdict, not entirely, but in large part, by the acoustics evidence that it had from its experts that suggested to it that there had not only been shots from the rear, where Oswald was in the infamous sixth floor book depository, but also from the right front. Since then, other studies have concluded that the first acoustic scientist got it wrong, and there is a continued to and fro. I mean, behind all this conversation that we're having today and the coverage of the last few weeks, people at home in their cars listening to the radio should know that there is, aside from the what one might call the loopier conspiracy theorists, there is a whole company of really decent scholars and very interesting people who study the science, if what I would call the science of conspiracy, both at the level of the medical evidence, the autopsy evidence, and so on, and the acoustics evidence, and it's in small focus. This side of the thing demonstrates exactly what I said earlier in the general sense, that the scientists don't agree, the acoustics people don't agree. And I think if everyone was able to live long enough, they would still be found arguing, in 50 years' time. And the reason they're arguing is because the information is unclear, and doesn't lead to definite answers.
Some people say that John Wilkes Booth actually lived into old age and wasn't the one that was shot in Virginia.
Yes, so not my story, on, but of course, it could course go people on for still are arguing and debate. There are still people who are debating the Lincoln shooting, and I suspect that they will still be debating the Kennedy case in not just in 50 years' time, but in 100 years' time.
Hmm. What about these?
It seemed to have been that way, though. I don't know. I'm not a man on the Lincoln case, although, of course, I've read about it, but it needn't have been this way with the Kennedy assassination. Right at the beginning, some listeners may not be familiar with what I'm about to say, but right at the beginning, the investigation was flawed. By law, the autopsy on the president should have been done in Texas. And they do actually have a little experience shootings in the state of Texas. But what happened was that the Secret Service demanded that the body be taken immediately to Washington, and it was removed with an absolute lack of dignity, with the Secret Service holding a local Dallas judge and officials from the hospital up against the wall at gunpoint. That's how it began. So the autopsy wasn't done right there. It was removed to Washington, where the autopsy, everyone has accepted, even attorneys who worked on the Warren Commission, the autopsy was bungled in multiple ways. And I would hope that a relative of mine, or a homeless man even, killed by gunshot wounds, would get a more efficient and more thorough autopsy than President Kennedy got. One of the great scandals, of course, and people trot this out every so often, but it's worth trotting it out, I think. The president's brain, crucial to the autopsy, obviously, because he died of gunshot wounds to the head, was not, that's not the right word, not frozen, but was not preserved chemical in the way that it should have been in order that the bullet wounds could be tracked and traced to the extent possible. And what's more, after that, simply went missing. The president's brain is missing. Sounds like the title of a bad novel.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder who has it.
Oh, I certainly don't know, but I did talk to the president's secretary, Evelyn Lincoln, before she died. And it was clear that she knew and at some point had good information about the whereabouts of the brain. There are memos about a container that she personally was asked to pick up, and I think it was on behalf of Robert Kennedy. I suspect that behind that, the fact that the brain's missing is not some sinister purpose, but the idea that Robert Kennedy, who was absolutely in pieces, not just for weeks, but months and months, even some say years, emotionally speaking, after the assassination, wanted to see that his brother's brain didn't become some kind of gruesome exhibit and that he disposed of it as he chose right.
Hmm. We're speaking with Anthony Summers. His book is entitled Not in Your Lifetime, 50 Years On, Weighing the Evidence. And it's Topical Currents. We're going to take another short break, and we'll be back. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and journalist Anthony Summers. His latest book is entitled Not in Your Lifetime, 50 Years On, Weighing the Evidence, the defining book on the JFK assassination. We're going to get to your calls, but I want to ask you, Mr. Summers, you mentioned about the millions of pages of assassination records that were made public in the late 90s, and yet you say that the CIA is withholding more than 1,000 documents under national security until 2017, and you ask why these records are being held back if, as we were told, Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone assassin. So why do you think it is that these records are being held back, and do you think they'll be released in 2017?
Well, I can't say what's what's going to happen in 2017. But you go to the reason that my book is called Not in Your Lifetime. I did call it that in the second edition in the late 90s, but I think the title is all the more apt now. The title comes from the fact that Chief Justice Earl Warren, when asked whether all the documents of the first investigation would be made public, he said yes, and then he paused and said, well, that there may be some material that involves national security that will not be released in your lifetime. And as you say, one wonders what there could be 50 years on if the Warren Commission report is as clear-cut and simple as it is, that Lee Harvey Oswald did it on his own with no known motive, and that's all there was to it, then why should there now, in 2013, be material withheld on grounds of national security? I think I have some notion of why some material may be withheld, and it is very interesting. Oswald went to Mexico City in late September 1963, so just 6 weeks-ish before the assassination of President Kennedy. While he was there, he visited the Cuban consulate and the Soviet consulate, apparently in search of a visa to go to Castro's Cuba. They didn't grant it to him. The Cubans say that the reason they didn't grant it was they thought that he was a CIA agent provocateur, some sort of operative. Now, that may seem silly on its face, but if one sees the enormous amount of documentation on the Mexico City visit, generated by the Mexico visit, and as important, the documentation that we don't have, some of it we know has been destroyed, tape recordings and photo coverage of the surveillance that was done automatically at those consulates by the CIA. We know that they survived. We know that audio surveillance tapes, in particular, survived until April 1964. That's 4 or 5 months after the assassination. And yet, that they have since been destroyed. Well, why would that be? Reading between the lines, and I think this is, I mean, what I'm about to say is a careful read between the lines. I think that Oswald was wittingly or unwittingly being used in one of the many black propaganda operations that were being run by U.S. intelligence against Castro's Cuba. I don't think that necessarily had anything whatsoever to the assassination of President Kennedy, but that when Oswald was linked to the assassination, there were those officials, certainly in the CIA, perhaps also in the FBI, who literally ran for cover. I mean, the sort of notion of, my God, we don't want to have been associated with this alleged assassin Oswald in any way. Mm-hmm. And by covering that up, that they've managed to cover up, that they've managed to make it look as though there's something far more sinister being concealed.
Right. You mentioned the president's brother, Robert, then attorney general. Till his dying day, being assassinated, he maintained that he thought there was a conspiracy. Is that correct?
No, yeah, I'm afraid. Once again, it's not as simple as that. What Kennedy actually thought died with him. There's a rather good book written by a colleague of mine called David Talbot, who's really tried to trace that with the assistance of some members of the Kennedy family, and particularly Robert Jr. It seems that he said, one of the last things he said before he himself was assassinated, just after I'd interviewed him, actually. That was a strange and savage time. That he himself said that only when he got it, if he got into the White House, which was, of course, beginning to seem very likely in 1968, would he be able to properly look into the case. There's another school of thought which says that for good reason, Robert Kennedy, who had been running Cuban matters for his brother, even though he was Attorney General, he was running Cuban matters and the secret war against Cuba, that the Kennedy brothers had themselves been aware, allegedly, of the plots to kill Castro, and that it was determined that this absolutely should not come out, so that the Kennedy President Kennedy's brother himself had cause, certainly at the time, not to probe further.
Let's take a telephone call. This is George. He's in Weston. Hi there.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Yes. First, I remember seeing Harvey on TV, and he said, "I'm a patsy," and then he said, "No, sir, I didn't kill anybody or I didn't shoot anybody," and it sounded totally truthful to me, just his voice. And then secondly, if as some people believe, LBJ orchestrated this because he wanted to be president, or it's a mafia connection, or it's any Castro connection, what would have been the great tribulation that would have befallen the government if the people who some people, you know, they say they knew, the Warren Commission knew, somebody knew stuff they just didn't want to say, what would have been so terrible that could have happened to the government if they had come out and said, "Oh yes, we knew about this, we knew about that"?
Anthony?
That's quite a mouthful. First, let me say, because I think it needs saying, there's been a lot of nonsense spoken in recent days about the notion that Lyndon Johnson had something to do with the assassination. I have seen not even one small fragment of anything that you could call evidence or any factoid worth a damn that suggests that LBJ had anything to do with the assassination before the event. What is interesting, I think, is that this man taking over the presidency at a terribly tense moment. Remember, this was just a year after the Cuban Missile Crisis, when it really seemed that nuclear war was about to break out, inherited a terrible situation. According to the former chief counsel of the Assassinations Committee, he learned while working for the committee that the bombers went on to higher alert right after the assassination, that fighters took off in the direction of Cuba and of communist Cuba, and held at the international line in the ocean there, and then finally were recalled. It is rather clear that, not just from my book, but from other scholarship, that what LBJ did was essentially to put the lid on the saucepan to the possible horrors that could come from the thing becoming out of control, suspicion of both the Soviets and the Cubans, actually, that he put the lid on the saucepan, closed it down, and that the effective request to Chief Justice Warren was to keep it closed down. And this may have been a great and initial statesmanlike act by Lyndon Johnson, although, of course, it may, as a byproduct, have had the effect of closing off all sorts of other information that we ought to know about.
Let's talk about another part of the enigma, Anthony Summers, and that would be Jack Ruby.
Yes. Well, Jack Ruby, of course, killed Lee Harvey Oswald a day or two later as he was being moved from the police station to the county jail. And the first anomaly on that front is that the Warren Commission, in one of its most flagrant pieces of disinformation, said that there was no connection, no significant connection between Ruby and organized crime. And that's simply not true. The House Assassinations Committee established that from his birth, from his childhood, in what had been Al Capone's Chicago, that Ruby had indeed had links to organized crime that went on and on. The claim, of course, that he made, or his defense lawyers made, was that he killed Oswald for emotional reasons, sort of a spur-of-the-moment emotional thing. It was silly nonsense, like he's supposed to have done it so that Jacqueline Kennedy wouldn't have had to come back to Texas for a trial of Oswald. When I was researching this, I was digging around in a Dallas station, not expecting to find it very much, but in connection with the documentary I did for the BBC, and I found an abandoned videotape there that was a recording of Ruby in the middle of his trial during a recess. And he said in that, he talked in a very funny, sort of weird sort of way, but here's what he said: "The only thing I can say is everything pertaining to what's happened has never come to the surface. The world will never know the true facts of what occurred, my motive. In other words, I'm the only person in the background to know the truth pertaining to everything relating to my circumstances." I mean, he really wasn't very good at making himself clear in English. But he also told people in the prison that he'd been framed into killing Oswald, that word framed again, and that he knew who had President Kennedy killed. Well, one can, of course, say that he would say that, wouldn't he, in order to shift the blame for killing Oswald from himself. But the short answer is that the Ruby side of the affair, like so much else, remains an enigma.
We're speaking with Anthony Summers. He's a journalist and the author of Not in Your Lifetime, the defining book on JFK assassination. One more short break and we'll come back and take more calls. And thanks for joining us for today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and journalist Anthony Summers about his latest book, Not in Your Lifetime, 50 Years On, Weighing the Evidence About the JFK Assassination.
And of course, we'll have the links to the book at both the Topical Currents Facebook page and our website, that's WLRN.org.
And if you want to join in the conversation, the number is 1-800-743-9576. So I'm interested in this Miami connection. Who is this anti-Castro Cuban exile, Herminio Diaz, and what link did he have, or what did you find in your research about him?
Well, this is a new thing and an interesting thing. In 2007, I was still in touch over the years with the former chief counsel of the House Assassinations Committee, Professor Blakey. Blakey got in touch to tell me that he'd had a contact from an old man in his 80s in Greater Miami called Reynaldo Martinez, and that Martinez, as he got into his 80s, he said he wanted to get something off his chest in old age while he was still alive. And we set up, first of all, a conference call with Martinez to see whether he had anything to say worth listening to. And I sat in London at the time, actually, and Professor Blakey sat at Notre Dame. We had an interpreter because the guy had very little English, and we talked to him, and he described the scenario, and he did it in a way that sounded to us sufficiently significant that we ought to go to see him. Our paths did take us to Miami, and we went to see Senor Martinez in his house and spent 2 days with him, during which the pair of us interviewed him, how can I put it, as toughly as you could talk to somebody who's way up in their 80s. And we came away feeling that he was telling us the truth as he knew it. And what he told us was that he had been told, while in a Cuban prison — he'd been in a Cuban prison for currency offenses and so on, nothing very serious, but he had been working because he was a kind of trustee. He'd been working in the infirmary at a time that Tony Cuesta, and this may be a name familiar to many of your listeners. The anti-Castro leader, Tony Cuesta, was brought in. He was terribly wounded following a failed anti-Castro raid by him and other anti-Castro fighters. He lost an arm, he was blinded, and he was having severe trouble with his ears, with his hearing. And Martinez, as a trustee, was helping him medically in the infirmary, and he came in for, I think, daily or twice daily to have drops put in his ears, something like that. And at the time, Cuesta thought he was still very likely going to die. And among the they discovered the two men, that they had a mutual friend, and this is the name to remember, in Herminio Diaz. And Cuesta said that before he died in the raid in which Cuesta had been so badly injured, that Diaz had said that he had had participation in the assassination of President Kennedy. Now, that's all he said. But what was interesting to me and Professor Blakey, having heard from down the years so many sort of nutcases and people who said they knew this and that about the Kennedy assassination, that this was the first time in 50 years that one heard from somebody who seemed to tick all the boxes in terms of the assassination scenario as we know it.
You mean with a motive?
Diaz, no, Diaz, the man that was named as having admitted to having had a role in the assassination, mm-hmm. He ticked all the boxes in this sense. He was a marksman. Martinez had grown up with him, had seen him. I mean, he was a guy who, by the time he was 19 or 20 years old, was hardly ever without a rifle or a pistol. He was not only a marksman, but he had killed. He'd killed some 20 people. Some of them I was able to find a record of in the old clipping files and in government documents and so on. He had killed a former police chief in Central America. He tried to kill the president of Costa Rica, and he'd been involved in plots to kill Castro's predecessor, Batista. Equally significantly, and perhaps more significantly, he had worked for Santo Traficante, the mafia boss, who was suspected by the assassination committee of involvement in President Kennedy's assassination. And he was in the United States at the time of the Dallas killing occurred. So given the way that it came to us and the sort of source, and we found the source a credible source in terms of what he was saying to us, he had nothing to gain by talking to us. We felt that this was something that deserved real attention and possibly may have come closer than anyone ever had before to putting a name to a man who may have fired in Dealey Plaza.
And we have just a little bit.
I just want to know what happened to Herminio Diaz.
Herminio Diaz died in the off the Cuban coast in 1966 in the same raid in which his leader, Tony Cuesta, was almost fatally wounded.
Okay.
Let's squeeze in a quick phone call. We're very short on time, but this is James in Pinecrest. Hi.
Yes, good afternoon. Yes, Mr. Summers, I used to be one of the counsel to the Assassinations Committee, and I remember working on the Ruby part of the case, and we came up with a phone call from his brother Earl, as I recall it, to Havana, Cuba. And we could not at the time run it out, find out where it went, but it came up on his phone records at the Cobo Cleaners in Detroit, as you may have recalled. And I'm wondering if you ever came across anything similar.
I think I did come across that reference, and perhaps I'm sure you don't want to give your name out while we're on the air, but I would be glad if afterwards or later you could give it to one of the production staff for this program.
Yeah, have him call Richard Ives here at the station.
And that Richard Ives would certainly pass that to me. I did read something about that at one point. I think it is it not in the notes or in one of the volumes?
He's not on with us anymore.
Oh,
because we're just about out of time.
I think it is interesting. The Cuba connection for Ruby, which we haven't mentioned earlier, is itself interesting because it appears that at an earlier date, at the time of the Castro Revolution, Ruby went to Cuba and in some way liaised with Santo Trafficante when he was in a concentration camp.
Well, we hope his name was Jack.
James.
James, that he calls back, Richard Ives, please. We've been speaking with Anthony Summers, a journalist and the author of Not in Your Lifetime, 50 Years On, Weighing the Evidence, the defining book on the JFK assassination. Thank you very much, Mr. Summers, for joining us.
Thank you both.
And thank you for listening. Our producer is Richard Ives, technical direction by online producer Paul Leary. Free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org, and more information and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program begins with information about Broward County's Complete Streets and Bicycle-Friendly program. The number of bicyclists is growing. And more, Linda Gassenheimer's annual Thanksgiving dinner tips, including gravy making. It's all in the roux. And today's calendar, on this day in 1925, 88 years ago, oddly enough, the birth of Robert Kennedy in Brookline, Massachusetts, a Navy vet. He earned a law degree at the University of Virginia. After pursuing organized crime before Congress, he held great power as Attorney General, then as Senator. And on this day in 1929, 84 years ago, the birth of America's oldest teenager, the late Dick Clark, in Mount Vernon, New York. The first national broadcast of American Bandstand was in 1957. One more while we head to Camp Granada. On this day in 1973, 40 years ago, the death of musician and satirist Alan Sherman. He created and produced I've Got a Secret. The novelty tune Hello Mudda, Hello Fada reached Billboard's number 2 in 1963. So we leave with a parody from Alan Sherman. Somewhere over the rainbow, way up tall, there's a land where they've never heard of cholesterol. Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. Stay with us. It's Here and Now from NPR News.
You can enjoy